topic is draft exemptions from the IDF. Okay? So the truth is, we tend to think that, you know, the issue of draft exemption, we're talking about controversy, the modern state of Israel, we tend to think that this begins, you know, in 1948. The truth is, there's actually a letter by Rav Kook in 1917 when the British, I just translated it, but it's Igrot HaRe'iyah. These are letters by Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of, you know, before Israel, before modern state of Israel, but modern Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Kook in 1917, when the British captured Eretz Yisrael from the Turks, and they were interested in enlisting Jews to the armed forces, Rav Kook wrote an impassioned letter to the chief rabbi of England, Rabbi Dr. Joseph Hertz, to influence the authorities not to enlist yeshiva students. And this is what he writes in volume 3 of Igrot HaRe'iyah, page 88. He writes, "Our goal is clear and single, to save the Jewish neshama in this kingdom. For many reasons, this depends upon the survival of the few yeshivos. It is clear that if the right of B'nai HaYeshiva to be exempt from army service is annulled at this point, the yeshivos established with great toil and mesiras nefesh will irretrievably collapse chalila. The success of the country in its war depends upon Talmidei Chachamim toiling in Torah. In their merit, the war will be won. They help the country more than the fighting troops, etc." And again, just to be fair, I don't think it would necessarily be true to assume that Rav Kook would say, okay, 1948, that no yeshiva students should serve. Or would he say that now? We don't know what he would say. He said this in 1917 about this had to do, this is about Jewish yeshiva students enlisting in the British Army. We don't know what he would say about a Jewish army defending a Jewish state. But it's just interesting to note that this quote, this the first, you know, quote I found dealing with, you know, yeshiva students serving in the army in modern times is actually about 30 years before the state of Israel was created. Now, as the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine was considering whether to endorse the creation of a Jewish state, David Ben-Gurion, as chairman of the Jewish Agency Executive, sent a letter on June 19th, 1947, to the ultra-Orthodox Agudas Yisrael in order to form a united policy to present to the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, which had commenced its fact-finding tour 4 days earlier. The letter was meant to address their concerns that the emerging state of Israel will be a secular one, which might hurt the status of religion and religious institutions as well as the values of their followers. So in the letter, right, this is the letter. If you see that he wants to, that Ben-Gurion basically says here, as you were informed by the, so he's writing, this is the letter, okay, it's June 19th, 1947, and he is discussing issues of matrimony in the first paragraph, Shabbos, education, and kashrus in the Jewish state, okay, and he writes here the following, that Shabbos, it is clear that Shabbos will be the legal day of rest in the Jewish state. Permission will be naturally given to Christians and those practicing other religions to rest on their weekly day of rest. Kashrus, all means should be pursued to ensure that every state-run kitchen serve kosher food. Marital law, all the members of the executive appreciate the seriousness of the problem and the grave difficulties pertaining to it, and all the bodies represented in the agency's executive will do whatever possible to satisfy the deep need of the religiously observant in this matter regarding family laws. And essentially out of this, that that basically you would have rabbinical courts adjudicating on issues of marriage and divorce that arose from marital law. And education is that full autonomy will be guaranteed to every education network, and the state will not infringe on their religious philosophy. In other words, Ben-Gurion states that, again, this is June 19th, 1947. This is a few months before Chavtes B'November, right? The 29th day of November, when the UN voted on their partition plan. So we're talking a few months before. And basically, this was actually about this. The United Nations Special Committee They began this fact-finding tour 4 days before, and basically he says that the Jewish agency executive and no other body is going to infringe or determine the character of the Jewish state with respect to these four issues. That number one, we're agreeing that Shabbos will be the day of rest, and that kashrus, you know, there'll be kosher in Israel, in a Jewish state. And there'll be a single judicial system for marriage and divorce conducted by rabbinical courts. And basically each Jewish denomination will have full autonomy to basically stipulate how their educational system will be worked. And this letter was signed by David Ben-Gurion, Rabbi Y.L. Fishman. That's Rabbi Yetzihuda Lev Fishman / Maimon. He was the leader of the Mizrahi Party who served as the Minister of Religion of State of Israel from 1948 to 1961. And Yitzchak Grinboim. He was the first Minister of the Interior of the State of Israel. Now, what's important for our perspective is that this document it addresses four important issues, but it does not address other potential contentious issues commonly associated with the status quo today. In other words, exemptions for military service for yeshiva students and religiously observant girls, pig farming, El Al flights on Shabbos, archaeological excavations, autopsies, abortion, and essentially the religious parties raise these issues only after the original status quo agreement. And these issues, by the way, reflect the Orthodox Party's success at extending their influence beyond the initial parameters of the status quo agreement. In other words, initially, the status quo agreement only dealt with these four issues, and they did not deal with the issue that we are discussing this afternoon, which are exemptions from military service. And that's what we're focusing on. So that's an interesting point of note, that it was not addressed in the so-called status quo agreement, dealing with core issues from this June 1947 letter. On March 9th of 1948, 600,000 Jews living among Arabs, and there were 600,000 Jews living among Arabs, and enlistment was obligatory upon every man and woman below the age of 45. Now, despite being desperate due to a lack of manpower, the Haganah head of staff, who was Yisrael Galili, he exempted yeshiva students from conscription by order of David Ben-Gurion, and the order read, it has been decided that the B'nai HaYeshivot, according to the authorized list, are exempt from army service. The decision is binding for 5708. At the end of the year, the problem will be re-examined. Now, in Yerushalayim, there was an attempted compromise which the Rabbanim rejected. There was a compromise attempted whereby yeshiva students would receive self-defense training in the yeshivos with the understanding that they will go into action in circumstances of necessity and pikuach nefesh. But this was rejected. At that time, the exemption was only for 400 students, which was 0.07% of the total population. It has been suggested, now don't get me wrong, it's not like Ben-Gurion was this very religious individual, that he was so pro-religion. He was, not only was he not religious, he was tend to be anti-religious. And again, that was his philosophy, that it has been suggested that Ben-Gurion was a smart political pragmatist. And he understood that the various segments of the Haredi community shared an overwhelming antipathy towards Zionism and the establishment of an independent Jewish state through means other than the coming of the Mashiach. In order to silence Haredi opposition to the recommendations of the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry, which was deliberating over the future of Palestine in 1946, Ben-Gurion negotiated a number of religious concessions with Haredi leaders, one of which would eventually lead to the exemption of 400 yeshiva students from IDF conscription. Now, in 1948 to 1949, in the winter of 1948 leading into 1949, Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Herzog requested an extension of the wartime exemption of 400 students, arguing, quote, after the awful Holocaust in which tens of thousands of yeshiva students were destroyed in Europe, leaving only a pitiful remnant. It is my opinion that they be freed from compulsory military service in order to allow these few to continue the study of our holy Torah, which is also to the glory and the necessity of our state. And if you see, I just brought you in source 3 here a quote from different Rabbanim at the time. You have Rav Charlap, who was a leading Rav at the time, and he was, I believe he was a student, one of the students of Rav Kook, and he said, it is our Torah opinion that every yeshiva student should know that his rightful place is amongst the army of God. He has no obligation to enlist or to register for any military service whatsoever. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, this is our Torah opinion issued as a clear halachic decision. No yeshiva student who regularly occupies the Beit Midrash should enlist or register for anything connected to guard duty, military draft, or the like. It is forbidden to question this ruling or to engage in discussion or make concessions over it or to seek grounds for latitude, even temporarily. However, there are other prominent rabbanim, like Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, who disagreed. He said, he wrote, with all due respect and admiration for the teachers and rabbis, Gonim of the holy city, he meant of Yerushalayim, there is room to ask. Please instruct us. From what source do you derive this conclusion? Whence do you presume that yeshiva students of Talmidei Chachamim are exempt from participating in a Mechemes Mitzvah to assist Jews against sworn enemies intent upon their destruction and annihilation, God forbid? Whence do you presume to publicize in the form of a halachic decision and das Torah that yeshiva students need not register, be counted, report, or anything? So there was different views, and I think, again, it's very important. Just like it would be incorrect to assume that someone's view of Zionism is in 1948 would necessarily be his view of Zionism in the Jewish state in 2020, I don't think it's fair to assume that necessarily, might be, that someone's view about their role of should yeshiva students serve in the military in 1948 would necessarily be their viewpoint in 2020. In other words, would an exemption of 400 students, someone who would advocate for an exemption of 400 students, still say that for an exemption of 1,000 students? Maybe yes, maybe no, but that's just important to know when we're sort of evaluating, you know, what people said. It's important to know when they said it. Now, in January 9th, 1951, the Prime Minister ordered the Israelis Army Chief of Staff to exempt yeshiva students from regular service. There was a famous meeting in October 20th, 1952. And this is when Ben-Gurion visited the Chazon Ish to discuss this issue. The Chazon Ish, Rav Avram Yeshaya Karelitz, he was the Gadol Hador in Eretz Yisrael of the Haredim following the creation of the state, and he was a halachic giant. There's no question about he was the Gadol Hador at that time. This is what Ben-Gurion writes in Source 4 from his diaries. This morning I went to visit Bnei Brak for a meeting with the Chazon Ish. The press thought it was to be a sensational visit, and I encountered crowds along the way and around his house. A group of his followers waited outside in the nearby rooms. Yitzchak Navon was the only one who came in with me. I asked him the question to which I have yet to receive a sufficient answer from my observant friends. We are divided in different ways. In the matter at hand, we are divided by our views of religious tradition. There are Jews like you and like me. How do we live together? How will we become a unit? Again, Ben-Gurion, he was a political pragmatist. He understood that there's a crucial need for achdus in the Jewish people, and he wanted to find a way to try to get the Haredim to serve in the army, to create some sort of achdus. So there's a picture on the left with David Ben-Gurion with Yitzchak Navon. That was his assistant and future Israeli president over here. I don't know who this over here. But Yitzchak Navon also recorded this famous meeting. You have a picture of Chazon Ish on the right. I have a report in Ma'ariv, the newspaper, on this momentous meeting. Ben-Gurion Noad im Chazon Ish. Ben-Gurion meets with the Chazon Ish, October 20th, 1952. Now, the Chazon Ish famously quoted a Talmudic passage during their meeting. This was, and basically he quotes him, it's basically, there are different versions of this parable. It's clearly taken from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf, Lamed Beis, Lamed Beis, where he says the following, that says that Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, you should seek justice. Echad ledin ve'echad bipshara. So one with regard, it says pursue justice. Why does it say Tzedek Tzedek twice? So one with regard to judgment and one with regard to compromise. Ketzad, how so? Shnei gamalim shayu oli b'malos beis choron. Let's say you have two camels that are ascending the ascent of Beit Choron. It's very narrow. It's a steep path. And only one set of camels can pass by. Upagu zeh v'zeh. Imalu shneim nofli. If they both try to pass, they're both going to fall. B'zeh achar zeh, shneim olim. If one goes after the other, both of them can make it through. So ha ketzad. So how do you go about doing this? So who goes first? So he writes the following: Tuuna v'sheina tuuna, tidacha sheina tuuna v'nei tuuna. He says if one of them is laden with like a lot of burdens, one camel has a lot of burdens, and one camel does not have any burdens, does not have stuff on it. So the one that is not laden should wait. And the one that is laden with a burden should go first. Okay? So there are different versions according to this, the way this story, this pair, this famous mashal, and they discuss this in front, when they discuss it after the fact. So some say it was with wagons, some say it was with camels, some say it was with boats. The Gemara here, this Gemara here is talking about camels. But in any case, so you have, the parable was that the Chazon Ish told Ben Gurion. You have, right, these two camels, the two wagons, and the one that is not laden with burden should give way to the one that's laden with the burden. So he says to Ben-Gurion, we, the Haredi community, bear the burden of Torah and its mitzvos. Therefore, the non-religious Zionists must defer to us and move out of the way. According to Navon, the Chazon Ish continued that the Orthodox bear the burden of religious law, while the secular do not feel bound by it. There are other versions of what the nimshel was. You know what the moral of the story is? The application is that maybe the Chazon Ish compared the burden of ancient Jewish tradition to that the Orthodox uphold. He says the secular worldview is quite new. The Orthodox camel contains 2,000 years of Jewish tradition and therefore must receive precedence. Although maybe if he would have said that, then Ben-Gurion could have responded, while the Orthodox follow a Talmudic tradition that's 1,500 years old, the secular Zionists follow a 2,500-year-old biblical tradition. Although, again, hard to know exactly. There are different versions. What does it mean that the Orthodox, the Haredi community, bear a burden? Does it mean that they bear a longer Mesorah or that they bear all these traditions that the seculars don't bear? Ben-Gurion, according to Navon, attempted to mount a counter-argument. He said, and the second camel, isn't that weighed down with the burden of mitzvos? What about Ben-Gurion turns to Chazon Ish, he says, what about the mitzvah to settle the land? And what about the mitzvos to defending life? Aren't those mitzvos? What are those boys whom you are so opposed to sitting on the borders and protecting you? That's not a mitzvah? The Chazon Ish was not even able to agree, according to Navon, that the learners' lives were protected by those serving in the army. Rather, he insisted that it is only thanks to the fact that we learn Torah that the soldiers are able to exist. We are going to analyze these arguments at the end of the lecture. I'm going through the history first, and then we're going to go through just a few of the major arguments and how to respond. At the end of the meeting, the Prime Minister's office issued the following press statement. It says, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion met privately with Rabbi A.Y. Karolitz in Bnei Brak yesterday. The purpose of the visit was to exchange general views regarding the following issue. How can observant and non-observant Jews live together harmoniously in the state of Israel? The question of recruiting women to the army was not discussed, and the visit had no relation to current political matters. In 1954, there was an attempt to overturn Ben-Gurion's ad hoc deferment when Defense Minister Pinchas Lavon gave instructions to enlist yeshiva students who had been exempt for 4 years or more. But Prime Minister Moshe Sharet instructed Lavon to cancel his instruction. Again, we're talking about labor prime ministers who are for the most part anti-religious, and they probably feel it's not worth it at this time to, they have all these enemies externally, to anger the Haredim, it's probably not worth it. And therefore, they're trying to be pragmatists in this regard. Ben-Gurion and his party continuing granting deferments when Agudas Yisrael was absent from the governing coalition between 1952 and 1977. A special ministerial committee was established in 1968 that the number of new exemptions would not pass 800 a year, but that rule was ignored. Now, what happens is, between 1948, when we're talking about 400 exemptions, the number increases, right? It was 800 in 1975, 17,000 in 1987, over 26,000 in 1995, 28,000 in 1997, and 61,000 by 2010. So the numbers changed significantly. And just as a percentage of those enjoying deferments, as comparing with the total number of people who were drafted at that age, is 5.4% in 1987, 6.4% in 1995. That's the percent of those who were drafted. And 7.4% in 1996, 8% in 97, 14.7% in 2007. So again, you can imagine that this is obviously a point of contention. It's not fair. Why are they not giving up their lives? It's one thing when it's a small percentage. As it gets more, then obviously there's greater frustration. And again, in 1948, 400 exemptions are 0.07% of the population of 600,000. In 1988, 18,800 is 0.5% of a population of 3.6 million. So that we're basically, it's about eight times as much of a percentage who are being exempted. Between 1970 and 1986, three appeals are made against the IDF exemption in the High Court, but they are all rejected. The courts rule that the authority belongs to the defense minister, and it has not been proved that his judgment was unreasonable under these circumstances. And again, you have this legal tension between, on the one hand, you have freedom, you have human dignity, which is right to freedom of religion, the right of yeshiva students to pursue religious studies, versus the right of equality. There's an uneven public sharing of the burden of military service. There was also, by the way, a social issue that since their occupation with yeshiva student, they are not allowed to work. So even those who would drop out of yeshiva do not enter the workforce for fear of being drafted. In 1998, in Rubenstein versus Minister of Defense, on deferment of military service for yeshiva students, Supreme Court President Aaron Barak explained the reason for deferment and its historical context as follows. He says the following: the original reason for the arrangement was the destruction of the yeshivas in Europe during the Holocaust and the wish to prevent the closing of the yeshivas in Israel due to their students being drafted in the army. Today, the objective no longer exists. The yeshivas are flourishing in Israel. There is no serious worry that the draft of yeshiva students, according to any arrangement, would bring about the disappearance of this yeshiva institution. The court therefore decided that blanket deferral of yeshiva students was illegal, and the Tal law was created in 2002 that would supposedly increase yeshiva enlistment. It was named after Justice Tal, who chaired a governmental committee upon the recommendations of which the law was adopted. According to this law, this is a sort of a summary of some major provisions of the Tal law in source 6. The Tal law authorizes the Minister of Defense to defer the military service of any Israeli national or permanent resident upon his request if he studies in yeshiva on a regular basis for at least 45 hours a week. During the time he spends in the yeshiva, does not engage in additional occupation if he is over 23 years of age and has enjoyed deferment for more than 4 years. He has declared that he has met the above conditions, and the head of the yeshiva in which he studies has affirmed that the applicant has met this condition. And he tells the Israeli IDF of any change in the situation. Essentially, the Tal law says that for 4 years, you can defer military service if you're studying in yeshiva. And then once you reach the age of 22, you have a year of decision. I don't have it written down here, but just to summarize, you have a year of decision in which you can either perform a year of vocational training and then decide whether to join the army for a minimum of 16 months, followed by annual reserve duty, or you can perform a year of unpaid civilian national service, Shirut Le'umi, if they decided not to continue to study full-time. And so that was the goal of the Tal. Again, it doesn't make it perfect, but, you know, they realized baby steps. Let's try to do baby steps hopefully this will increase, you know, give them their time in yeshiva and then give them their decision year. And then hopefully then either they'll serve in Sheirut Lumi or they'll serve in the army. In February of 2012, and then after that, they can enter the workforce. In February of 2012, the Supreme Court, by a 6-3 majority, they, after like 10 years seeing how the Tal law is working out, after, you know, 10 years, they ruled the Tal law had failed to achieve its purpose. The court ruled that the Tal law violated the right to equality, because it's still not equal, and the Knesset cannot further extend its application beyond the August 1st, 2012 date. It was extended, it started for 5 years, extended a little more. The court in 2012 said the Tal law is not working. Some justices found that although there was a slight increase in the number of Haredim who served in the military or the civil service, their number was insignificant relative to the number of Haredim who enjoyed the deferment. Court President Dorit Beinish determined that the Tal law's grant of an automatic deferment of 4 years between the ages of 18 to 22 and the determination of the latter as the earliest age for selecting a year of determination of or civil service diminished the ability of the army to absorb yeshiva students. Why is that? Because by the age of 22, the overwhelming majority of the Haredi population is already married, and most likely they probably have a child or two. And therefore, yeshiva students at this age who choose not to remain in the yeshivos are usually directed to a much shorter period of civil service and not to serve in the army. Having concluded that the means determined by the law did not achieve and cannot at a level of actual probability achieve its goals, Beinish suggested that the Knesset should reach a new arrangement that maybe could rely on the framework of the Tal law, but that you know ensures compliance. Meanwhile, 2013, Yair Lapid's political party, Yesh Atid, they became a significant party. They had, I think, 19 seats, I believe, in the new Israeli government. And one of their platforms was equal service. That the equal service law, which eliminated most draft exemptions. And more than that, they provided for not simply civil liability, but criminal penalties for draft evasions. However, as politics would have it in Israel, within a few years, it left the ruling coalition. UTJ and Shas joined the government in 2015 and they undid Lapid's law and they continued the exemptions. Because again, it was a decision. You know, it's an interesting question, right? When you have a fight between the right and the left politically, so what's most important to you? Is most important to you, let's try to have some kind of unity government and make the Haredim serve in the army and deal with their situation? Or no. And you know that is what you have to pick your poison. Who's going to be in your you know coalition party? That's an issue. And by the way, the issue of eliminating or curtailing the IDF exemptions became a political issue in the recent election. I think we had three elections. You know, to finally get a unity government. You know, between Netanyahu and Gantz, which you read about that it may soon fall apart. But this actually became one of the issues. For example, when Avigdor Lieberman, if you're paying attention, if you're following, that hit one of his platform, he was like the kingmaker. Like he could have, before Netanyahu and Gantz made a deal together, so he was like, he had, I think, about 9 seats, I believe, in one of the elections or one of the go-rounds. And he said, you know, I'll join, but we have to do something about the Haredim. They can't be part of the coalition because we need to... they need to serve in the army. We need to make some kind of rule. And so this is still a hot button issue. So that's sort of where we are now. In other words, it goes from 400 tens of thousands. And there's an attempt through the Tal law to try to sort of ease, to make things, you know, not 100% equal, but to ease their situation into the army. But that fails to achieve its purpose. There's an attempt to strong arm the Haredim, but they are a powerful influence in elections, and apparently they're the rest of Israeli society, as much as they don't like the fact that the Haredim serve in the army, they have greater issues than uniting around this particular platform. Now, what's the rationale for the Haredi rejection of the army service? So we saw the Chazon Ish mentioned this. The halachic argument that the Torah will protect the yeshiva students, they don't need protection. That's a discussion unto itself. Rabbi Lichtenstein, you know, writes that even if you argue, you know, there's a big question whether that's the case. Nevertheless, isn't there, even if you believe that's true, we're not going to go through that particular argument, but even if you believe that's true, isn't there a mitzvah of chesed? You have to care for other people. Isn't there a Mishnah in Sota which says that everyone goes out in a Melchemes Chova? It's very hard to make, but that's their argument, that they feel that somehow, you know, their learning protects people. They'll bring some sources to deal with that. I did bring you one source which many of them claim. This is the Rambam in Hilchas Shmita V'Yovel, the very last halacha in the Rambam's, you know, code of Jewish law and the laws of Shmita and Yovel, where he says that Sheva Levi is sort of exempt, that is sort of like exempt from engaging in, I would say, public, you know, engaging and being treated like the rest of the rest of the Jewish people when it comes to the army. This is the Rambam's position. By the way, Rashi seems to disagree. Rashi, when the Bnei Yisrael fight Midyan in Parshas Pinchas, I believe, so there the Torah says that they had, you know, the 12 tribes, and even Shevet Levi fought against Midyan. So Rashi would seem to disagree with the Rambam's point of whether Shevet Levi fights, but the Rambam goes beyond that, and he says not only Shevet Levi is exempt from fighting like the rest of the people, but he says anyone, any member of the world, anyone of the Asher Nadva Rucho also, whose spirit carries him, Vevino Madoli Badola Boli Fne Hashem Lesharso, and he understands to stand before God, to serve Him, La'avdo, to Ladeos Hashem, to know God, V'holach Yashar Kemosha Asoha Elokim, Uparak Be'al Tzavro, Olach Hashbonos Arabim, and basically he removes from his yoke of the many reckonings which people seek. In other words, if there's someone who's only focusing on Torah and he's not involved in the world at all, Harezen is Scottish Kodesh Kadashim, he is holy of the holies, V'yashem Chalkov and Achlasso La'ad, Lo'olam Olme Almaya, Olme Olamim, he is God's portion and the heritage forever, V'yizkalo B'lamazeh, and he will inherit, you know, the world to come, etc., etc. In other words, they argue that yeshiva students are like the Bnei Levi, since they're Torasa Umnaso, that they study Torah as a permanent profession, so they are exempt from the regular burdens of society. Rav Lichtenstein wrote a popular essay on the ideology of Hester, and I just brought you the source and how he deals with this argument. And he says the following. He says, first, the initial postulate that every Levite enjoys the dispensation from army duty has no source in Chazal. This line of the Rambam, that they don't have to serve in the army, you don't find that in Chazal, in the Gemara, in the Mishnayot, in the Gemara. On the contrary, it contravenes the evident purport of the Mishnah in Sota. The Mishnah in Sota says that everyone goes out to war, even the Chassid and the Kala. Chassid and the Kala, they get married, there's a case, there's a situation, there's a war, they all go out to the war. As it has often been noted, if the Rambam's formulation understood as a total bar of the army service by Shevet Levi, it would seem to be contradicted by the Gemara in Kiddushin. The would or should B'nai Torah readily lean upon such a thin reed in order to exempt themselves from, say, the mitzvot of lulav or shofar? Second, it seems most unlikely that this statement is indeed all it is presumed to be. It seems unlikely. If the Rambam had truly intended to postulate a categorical dispensation for B'nai Levi or B'nai Torah, would he have presented and formulated in this manner and context? He basically, the rest of this paragraph, he says, you know, the Rambam writes the laws of war in Hilchos Malachim. That's where he writes the laws of war. And in those laws of war, he says, everyone goes out to war. In Sefer Zrayim, which talks about, you know, tithing and working on the land. So there he simply says it's good to serve a Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's like a nice idea. The Rambam frequently at the end of Mishnah Torah, at the end of every like book of Mishnah Torah, of his code of Jewish law, he writes like a nice idea that, you know, that we should all serve Hashem but it's not it, if you're gonna choose. You have one halacha, which is in Hilchos Malachim, the laws where the Rambam talks about the laws of war, right? And you have this, you know, nice, you know, idea, nice idea that's more of like a gotic. You know, it's a nice idea at the end. So who are you going to follow? You follow that halacha. And he says, and finally, even if we grant that the Rambam's statement does imply, you know, an exception in halachic terms, it remains of little practical significance. We don't know who this applies to. A Levi is genealogically, you know, a Levi, the son of Levi. Okay, fine. But those who are equated with him, it's spiritual qualities. And the Rambam sets a very high standard. Some like really selfless person. And he says in the next paragraph, to whom does this apply to? 2%, 5%? Can anyone who has negotiated the terms of a salary, right? Both look into a mirror and tell himself, you don't have to go to the army because you're Kodesh HaKadoshim. He's like, who has the right to say I'm Kodesh HaKadoshim? According to the Rambam's term, can anyone with even a touch of vanity or a concern of kavod say this? Right? I see that, Howie makes the point, you know, in the chat that, they didn't say this during the Holocaust. And the truth is that the end of Rav Lichtenstein's article, he makes a similar comment where he said, I think in the 1950s, so when they were debating about Gius Banot, whether girls could serve the army, and Rav Lichtenstein said, I'm not taking a position on that. So there was like, a really Haredi rabbi who was like, he was by the border where there were rockets firing, and he was like scared. He dialed into Hashem, can you please save him, whatever. And so someone turned to him and he says, Do you still feel the same way about Gius Banot? So like, you know, you're right. So like this was, so Rav Lichtenstein attacked these arguments from a halachic perspective. I think though the Haredim bring these halachic arguments about Talmid Chacham don't need protection and the Shevet Levi argument, which I think you could argue very cogently, you know, applies a minority view. I think their major issue is that the culture of the army is not suited to Torah. There's many Haredi leaders argue that the attempt to enlist Haredim is a deliberate attempt to secularize them, to peel them away from religion and Torah study. Their main objection to army service is the overwhelmingly secular environment. The Haredi community was not going to place their young sons during their most impressionable years of their lives in the hands of a government that looked at their way of life with disdain, contempt, and outright hatred. In other words, I think it is true that, again, the founders of the State of Israel, the ruling party, the Labor Zionists, again, I'm not Chas V'Shalom, not making a judgment on this, but their viewpoint were not simply neutral in terms of religion, were not religious, they were anti-religious. They viewed that not simply we have to create a home for a Jewish homeland, but we need a new kind of Jew that basically centuries of ghettoization and persecution had robbed the Jews of their pride and strength, that we need a proud Jew that can fight for himself, that could farm for himself and build the land. The ghettoized Jew presented a pathetic image of a man stooped over and always at the mercy of his persecutors. We have to get rid of them. We need to be, the early Zionists called themselves Hebrews and not Jews. And they deliberately changed their German or Russian Yiddish names to sound more Hebraic. Like David Gruen became David Ben-Gurion. Shimon Persky became Shimon Peres. Their goal was to create a new identity. And then many of them viewed that the army is like a melting pot to create, you know, one group of similar like-minded Jews. Now, the religious Zionists were also concerned about the influence of the army on young men, and therefore in 1957, Dr. Zerach Warhaftig, who was deputy minister of religious affairs, he entered into negotiations with the Bnei Akiva Yeshivot of a Hester program which combined military service with yeshiva study, which was basically about 3.25 years of study and about 1.75 years of army service. By 1984, there were about 1,400 yeshiva exemptions and 700 enlistments in Hester under this program. The Hester program helps deal with some of the issues of the negative influence, because if you learn a number of years before going to the army and you enter into the army with a group of yeshiva students, and they're very often together, so there's less of a concern of the a negative impact it would have on your neshama. Similarly, Nachal Charedi was established in 1999 to provide the Charedi soldiers with shiurim, glatt kosher food, rabbinic support, minimal Chil Hashem, not connected with actual combat, and no women soldiers on the Nachal Charedi base. I cannot imagine, and maybe I'm wrong, I cannot imagine that Ben-Gurion thought that 400 exemptions would lead to tens of thousands of exemptions nowadays. In other words, probably, if you would ask your average person after the Holocaust, what will be with Orthodox Judaism in both America and Israel, you would say it would end up being, you know, it would eventually wither away. And I can't imagine Ben-Gurion would have thought that there'd be tens of thousands of exemptions every year. I personally understand the need for equality and sharing the burden that would obligate Haredim to serve in the IDF. I also understand the fear that serving in the IDF would have that would negatively impact their value system. I am skeptical that political situations or solutions would work, that we can now obligate young men to serve in the army. It's obviously very difficult. I think, seems to me, and again, this is a political observation, and I'm certainly not a great political expert in this regard. My sense is that the way to go is to continue to make life in the army easier for Haredim with more Nachal Haredi units. It seems that these politicians who very much feel that there's this unequal burden that the Haredi community does not share, as much as they disdain that, apparently it's not number one on their agenda. Because obviously the majority of people in Israel are not Haredi, and yet what? They are not joining together to form a political party, to form a unity government that forces the Haredim to serve in the army. They apparently have not taken that step because they probably feel that there are more important issues. Maybe us sitting in America, we may feel that this is the most important thing, and it's a Chil Hashem, and et cetera, et cetera. But apparently other people may disagree, and therefore it seems to me that based on that reality, that the goal is to make army life easier for the Haredim with more Nachal Haredi units, because the more that Haredim see that serving in the army is not an assault on their way of life, the greater the likelihood that they would be more favorable towards serving in the IDF. I'm not sure if forcing them to conscript will work, considering there's already a history. In other words, if we were to start now, so maybe we can say no. Once they have a misora, it's very hard to undo that. But this is an issue that is not going away, and this will likely be featured in the future as a significant issue and a platform of a political party in a future Israeli election.